Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it? Podcast like it's 1999.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it? 1999.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999, stumbling over a bank counter here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts. Stumbling over my words here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Neidbart.
And I'm Felisco.
And with us today is Jahan Bufia. Excuse me, screwed that up. Bufia.
Not the first time.
What a shithead over here. John is a writer, Vulture, Pace Magazine, W, Film Cred, and I believe a Big Rose Byrne fan. Is that how this happened?
Yeah. Heath Ledger too. Yeah.
I love the Aussies.
Yeah.
I love Brian Brown. So we are...
He's great in this.
The best.
Yeah. I had no idea what his name was until I saw this. But I think I'd seen him in a few films. But I didn't know
Cocktail,
who he was.
Obviously.
Cocktail.
And, I have not seen that.
It's fine. It's not good. Also the FX series with not a series on FX. The FX movies.
Yeah, there were two of them.
With Brian Dennehy are both really
good. Why am I feeling like he's in something else that I'm drawing a total blank on? My apologies.
He's like the kind of face that you see in a lot of films, but you don't really know who he is and you don't really bother to look him up.
I can't disagree with that. He's done a fair amount of Aussie TV as well, it seems.
I think everyone in this movie has. I think they all do like the soap operas.
It does have that vibe. Yeah. But yeah,
they're all club comics like Eric Bana. That's how you start in Australia. Then you do a sketch show and then you start killing people in Spielberg movies.
Yes.
Jahan, have you heard of this film before? Like, what brought you to this film? Had you seen it before this podcast?
No. Okay, no. I saw it on the list and I did not know of its existence, but... There was that photo shoot of Rose and Heath in Las Vegas that like always circulates on Twitter and Instagram from like those like nostalgia accounts. And I love that picture, but I thought it was just like some random photo shoot for some like rising stars from Australia. I had no idea this movie existed. I love Heath Ledger, but I've seen like five of his movies.
Yeah. I mean, he only did seven.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding. I
haven't even seen The Dark Knight. Which is like my biggest blind spot. Those are, I think, the only Nolan films I haven't seen. I think the Batman was my first Batman movie.
Wow.
I'm not a big DC person. I didn't grow up with those films.
Sure.
So like I was a child when those came out.
Sure. It's interesting. I also remember and have seen that photo shoot a bunch. It does circulate on Twitter pretty frequently.
Yeah.
Because obviously they've both become
become big icons.
And I had a vague recollection of this film. I had never seen it before, but I do remember there was a little bit of a moment when I felt like it got a little bit of buzz around 99. And part of it obviously is the fact that they immediately just radiate as movie stars. Like both of them, you're just like, these two are so watchable. They also, if I'm not mistaken, I think they dated around the time of this film as well, if I'm not mistaken.
How could they not have?
Yeah.
It feels sort of, so there is sort of like, they definitely have a real chemistry and you can really sense that these two people have really connected. And it is a really, I mean, that photo shoot, which I posted some photos from it yesterday as I was watching this film, they just, they're just really, really charming and watchable. And it's, you know, Kenny and I were texting a little bit about the film, and there's just something about these early movies when you see movie stars before they were movie stars.
Yeah.
And it feels like there's an inevitability to it. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're just like, how could these people not become movie stars? But so you had not heard of this film. You had not obviously seen this film prior to this. In 99, I obviously sent you a list of strange movies. It was a strange batch of films. But, you know, are there a lot of 99 films that speak to you? Have you seen a fair amount of them? Or is this
I think
before?
So, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't born in 1999. I was born in 2003. So
cool, I'm cool, cool.
A very different generation.
Don't be old over here.
This is awesome.
We're of like, I think, completely different generations. But I mean, as someone who watches like a lot of movies, I've obviously had my fair share. I like, you know, Fight Club and all those movies.
Sure.
Obviously can't think of any at the moment. No, yeah. I've just gone blank.
Your Eyes Wide Shuts,
I haven't
Elections.
Even seen Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah. Okay.
But I do like Election, And 10 Things I Hate About You, which is Heath. Sure. That was like...
Yes.
A movie for my childhood. That was like the one I obsessed over. I don't know if you guys like that one.
we did an episode on it many moons ago. And I remember Kenny and I and our guest at the time, Ashley Lyle, talked about how like that was his coming out movie, right?
It was
like
American Break.
Yeah.
Well, no, we do. It was a weird episode.
It was.
It was a weird episode.
We don't love that movie.
Because it's not that we don't love it. It's that like, no shade towards Ashley, but Ashley didn't like it. And
she didn't.
And she's very smart and very persuasive. So it was very hard to like ride. Not that I was like going into that movie, podcasting, like, I am going to ride for this movie. This is my movie. But like, if a massive fan of that movie had been sitting in Ashley's seat, I think that could have pulled Phil and I in a different direction. But she really didn't feel it and mostly just wanted to talk about Drive Me Crazy.
But I would also say,
which she did a couple months later.
She did come on for that later. But it does speak to what you're talking about the generational divide a little bit.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Ashley, myself, and Kenny are around the same age. And it didn't hit us at the same moment as it did for, it feels like, your generation to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Where we all just kind of looked at it like, this just sort of feels like a pale imitation of better teen comedies that had come out earlier.
But my daughter, who is closer to your age than my age, by a lot, loves 10 Things I Hate About You.
It's in amazing.
Her it's in her rotation now.
It's a feel-good movie.
Along with Mean
so.
Girls and Clueless, but 10 Things I Hate About You, because she has a cousin who's, she's nine. She has a cousin who's 13, and they'll just watch things together on loop. And that and Legally Blonde are pretty much, you know, the ones in the rotation. So I guess it's interesting that, that 10 Things I Hate About You, I think for people born this millennium has really kind of found its place as a classic.
Yeah. I think it has to do with nostalgia. Like now there's streaming services and like everyone wants like a piece of like the 90s and the early 2000s. It's like all in the fashion and everyone looks back at that and they're like, we don't have movies like that anymore. It's like some really crappy Netflix movie that fades into existence after 2 weeks on the charts. So
yeah, you make a really good point.
I don't want to play a horrible old man, but I'm going to be old and old man right now. Have you ever seen Demolition Man?
No.
You should see it. It's a great flick.
Do you know of its existence? Have you ever heard of this?
I've heard of it, but I don't know anything. So, like, I know the title. I've probably seen people say stuff about it.
It was Sylvester Stallone, Wesley Snipes, and Sandra Bullock. And it was basically like Sandra Bullock had these like this like three movie just explosion with that and Speed and While You Were Sleeping. And which happened well, like in the course of 18 months. And it takes place in the future, like in, I think, around the 2020s now. Right in the 2020s, right? Or maybe earlier.
After the fast food wars.
After the fast food wars. So it takes place in the future. And Sandra Bullock is a cop, a like future cop. And she's obsessed with 90s nostalgia. So she's obsessed with the time period because where these two guys came from. They kind of time travel via getting frozen in liquid.
It's amazing.
And just this is the first time I've seen my youth on someone's wall as like nostalgia.
Yeah, I know. And I'm looking at this.
It's like it's this wild experience being like, oh, wait, like I love Empire Records because I watched it as a child over and over again, like the day it came out.
Yep.
Like,
yep. I watched it many times.
And I watched it on like Netflix.
You found it on Netflix as you were figuring out like what from the 90s is worth keeping and what is worth throwing away.
No, I mean, I loved Liv Tyler. And so like, I think I went through this phase on like Tumblr where like, you know, like all those like really popular actresses are just like all over your social media. And I was like, I love Liv Tyler. I'm just going to watch like this movie that her outfit is so everywhere. And like, I love this movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's such a basic outfit too.
It's pretty. Yeah. I mean, it is interesting how it does feel like right now we're certainly in a weaponized nostalgia industry. And I think that the 90s and early 2000s are very much in the kind of ether right now. I mean, even just looking at, I don't know if you guys are watching The Dropout or The Girl from Plainville as well. Like they're trafficking in like the music of that period and sort of all this stuff where you're just like, Jesus, it wasn't that long ago. And yet it
Yellow Jackets too.
Yellow Jackets as well.
I haven't seen Yellow Jackets, but I was just thinking about The Dropout and The Girl from Plainville, which I haven't seen The Girl from Plainville yet, but I saw that they're doing like some Glee thing. And I think they're tapping into like all that like music and stuff from we're going into nostalgia for like a decade ago now, which is like crazy.
The final moment of the pilot.
Don't say anything.
It's a true story. It involves Glee, is all I'm saying. It is a true story, and it did happen. But my point is, I think you're right.
Joanna Robinson said it's like the best moment in TV history.
It's fucking
great.
I'm so excited for it.
It's also, it's interesting because I was watching with my roommate who is, I think, closer to your age. She's about 10 years younger than me. But still, she was talking about how like Glee is now nostalgia, which was nostalgia when it existed. Like it was already sort of playing to your Britneys and your Madonnas and all that kind of, it's very strange. It's like we're in some weird slipstream right now that I'm just
it happens
like,
all the time though. Yeah. It happens all the time. Like, I think when people think of like American Graffiti, you kind of like think of it's a 70s movie, but then you watch it, it's a set in the 50s. So you have this like double nostalgia thing that happens with a movie like that, or a movie like The Outsiders, where that's a movie that's set in the 50s. It was shot in 1980 with all these, you know, current old men movie stars. That happens all the time where people are, you know, like we're people are nostalgic in their moment for when they grew up. And then later they're found like by another generation who are almost like nostalgic for the nostalgia.
Yes.
Like there is something about like, I remember when they did the Britney episode, which was the first time I saw Britney taken in as nostalgia object, right? Yep. Like they did a Madonna episode, which made a lot of sense and was obvious. She was already, you know, iconic and had already like kind of had her like 20 years of fame. And but the Britney one was a really interesting one because the Britney one was, she was still kind of relevant and mm-hmm. it was still kind of on the tail end of her putting out pop music. Yeah. But yeah, now I think maybe to me at least, people who come to that Britney episode now might get a different idea of the way Britney was viewed in the moment, which like I think Britney at that moment was still viewed as someone who was on the way out. And that I think Glee brought her back as a, you know, like as the kind of person who could have her Vegas residency thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, it's kind of ironic that we're talking about Glee on our Two Hands episode, but I'll say that that show continues to be a fascinating kind of lightning in a bottle thing because, I mean, Kenny and I were big fans of it when it was
Loved
it for the first couple seasons anyway. And then as most Ryan Murphy things, it just careens off into some, you know, bizarro thing. And then unfortunately you also had, Corey Monteith's passing away. So it's like all these kind of confluence of stuff that happened. But I do think that that show really brought things back into the zeitgeist. The show was so big that I remember just like first of all, the Glee songs would start to pop on iTunes and then the original songs would start. I mean, it really was just this fascinating loop of pop culture that that show created. But to get back to Two Hands for a second, I do think that Heath Ledger's ascension is pretty fascinating in terms of how quickly he becomes a movie star, and then how quickly he's able to pivot to something much more than that.
The serious actor.
Yeah, in a very short span of time. And I would argue that that constricted timeline might have been part of his tragic sort of end, is that it didn't feel like it perhaps it was just too much too quickly. I don't want to speculate onto his headspace and to, you know, the various things that led to his unfortunate early death, but it's just, it is really interesting that the guy made, how many movies did he make, Kenny? Was it like 9? Is it even 9?
No, I think
he probably made like 16 or something.
If you don't count,
like,
okay.
I don't know. He did like a few films, but like he only has like a few that are really like well known to people.
It's about 20.
It's about 20 movies. Okay, so it's more than I thought.
But you know, it looks like he did 5 Australian films before 10 Things I Hate About You.
Right.
And then he had a few smaller roles that people don't really remember. Like he was in Monsters Ball, for instance.
It was a big role. I mean, it was a big role.
Sure, yeah. The Patriot, which I think was kind of a, you know, its own little guarantor after 10 Things I Hate About You. Not a particularly beloved movie, but like a very serious movie.
Yeah.
And then I think, you know, I don't love Knight's Tale, but I know some people really love Knight's Tale. And
I haven't seen it.
Knight's Tale really broke him out to some extent. And then, you know, I mean, Knight's Tale,
it should be said, Knight's Tale, like, I don't know if you remember the poster for Knight's Tale, Kenny, but the poster is literally just his giant face.
His beautiful
and it's
face.
Just like him, and he's a knight, and he's got shaggy blonde hair, and you're just like, it's Hollywood being like, this guy's a movie star.
I mean, I think of Heath's career as 4 movies. Like, I know he did a lot of other stuff, but I think of it as 10 Things I Hate About You, A Knight's Tale, Brokeback, Dark Knight. And I think like, and he was in other movies, no doubt, but like that's the, you know, that's the John Cazale of Heath Ledger, right?
Yes, I agree with that. Yeah. I think that it is interesting to kind of look at, you know, mixed in there, you've got 4 Feathers, which is a movie that straight up doesn't exist, but was a big Oscar play with Kate Hudson and Wes Bentley and Heath Ledger. It's a period piece. I think like a war period piece of some sort. Ned Kelly and The Order, Lords of Dogtown, which he's really good in, kind of disappears into that role. A movie that also just sort of...
Oh, I remember he was like an older guy in that. Not an old man, but he wasn't. I was trying to remember who he was in that movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was kind of like a little bit like Ryan Reynolds' role in Adventureland, right?
Yes, yes. It's interesting too that like he really was very... it feels like there's a moment, a turn for him where he starts to want to disappear into his roles, which again might speak to his mental state, that it really does start to become like Brokeback is a transformative performance. It's insane to think that it's the same guy from Two Hands that's in Brokeback. You know, and obviously Dark Knight is another sort of transformative. He's covered in latex and he's doing all sorts of shit to his face. And same with I'm Not There when he plays Bob Dylan in that.
Which he's great in that too.
Yeah, one's a good film.
It's just, he was obviously a tremendous actor, and it does feel like this is a really sort of, it's a really cool movie, Two Hands. And it does feel like you're seeing somebody new that you need to pay attention to.
Yeah.
Kenny, what did you think of the movie from 30,000 Feet? I know you really quite liked
it. I think it's an excellent movie and I loved it. For real. Like, I think like the heat of it, fantastic.
Sure.
I thought Brian Brown was amazing. We have seen so many shitty fucking crime bosses recently. I loved him. I thought Rose Byrne, I understand completely why he would risk it all for her,
which he
does. He literally risks it all for her. I think that's I think that's sold beautifully by Heath, and I think she is totally winning. I think all the plot mechanics work beautifully. And I think it's also funny. And I think it's, you know, like one of the great scenes in movie history to me is in Out of Sight when the schmuck is running up the stairs and blows his head off. You know, which just reminds me a little bit of, you know, let's not forget that these are guns and this can, you know, things can happen when you play with guns. I love the bank robbery in this movie. I love it so much. And I love fucking 8 minutes later, when the guy has died in the course of the bank robbery, the driver, and they are doing a impromptu moment of silence, and the other guy's son shoots the shotgun off through the roof by accident. And the guy is just like, God, I have a splitting headache. Like, not even like put that gun down. Like, that was a loud, inappropriate noise. It's just, it's funny because we did, and I don't know if you've seen this movie, Jahan, we did Holy Smoke, which is
it's on my watch list and I've never gotten to it.
I can't remember if it's set in New Zealand or Australia, but it's set a down under. And I think this is a much more interesting depiction of Australians, and I do think it was set in Australia, of Australians than that movie. Like, it's
that movie's weird.
It is weird, and the dynamic between the two leads in that character is a special sauce of that film. But this, just there's a confidence of tone and of a mission statement here that I totally get. And even like at the end of my little, you know, write up my notes, there are things I could nitpick, but I just said it's I think this is too good to nitpick. Like, I didn't love the stuff with his dead brother, but like, whatever, like whatever. Right. Like, that's how I feel because I loved so much of this.
You know, it's interesting. The more you talk about it, the more I liked it. My first blush with it is that I kind of was like, okay, so this is sort of an Aussie Guy Ritchie movie. And I don't say that to be
it's like Aussie noir, but
I think that if this was made now with Guy Ritchie, it would have been like 10 times worse because I don't like his movies that much.
I agree with that.
So I think if you compare it to like the Guy Ritchie of now, like the Gentleman Guy Ritchie,
I think
this would be like the worst movie you've ever seen in your life.
Totally agree with you. I'm gonna be more generous than you, Phil.
Okay.
I compared it to Danny Boyle a fair boil with a little helping of a little sprinkling of Martin Breast. And all seen through, you know, this Aussie lens, which like these, it's funny because this movie won the Aussie equivalent of Best Picture. Now they only give out movies to the awards to Australian films. And if you guys looked through what gets nominated, almost none of them make it stateside. Like a Campion movie will make it, or like a Baz Luhrmann movie will make
it.
Like the Great Gatsby won one year, but for the most part, it did. But for the most
part, such a cheat.
It's a bit of a cheat. But for the
Is Baz Luhrmann Australian?
Yes.
I honestly thought he was American. I had no idea. I never really bothered to look at his like Wikipedia or hear his voice.
He is the most Australian.
He's an Aussie. And I love his films
have like a very specific style.
Correct.
I don't know. Like it's, I don't really vibe with most of his films that aren't Moulin Rouge. So.
Well, that you said enough for me. As long as you love Moulin Rouge, this is going to go fine. But it's interesting. We just did a Jackie Chan movie.
We did.
Two Dragons. And I get the sense, because these Australian movies kind of exist in their own bubble, that they aren't subject to the same level of like preciousness that inflicted the American indie culture at the time. Now, we've just done a lot of American versions of this type of film over the last couple of weeks.
This is far worse than this film.
This is by far the best one. Yeah. This one has personality. This one has clear characters. This one has a crime syndicate that I understand. Mm-hmm. The mission is very simple. Deliver this. This one is playful. The woman dies. When like even the way the kid dies, the kid's hit by the car, it's not playful, but it's Tarantino-esque. It's like it's one of these things that's just like Tarantino, Paul Thomas Anderson. This is like sometimes shit happens. And the way it ties into the end is great. Yeah. I think if you look at it, there's just a Swiss clock energy to it. It just fucking makes sense. And the things I don't like I don't like the brother talking essentially from hell. And I always hate starting the movies, you know, in media res with some like thing that's just designed to you know, draw you in. I think that's totally unnecessary. I don't think that worked at all.
It really took out like the suspense of that moment, or like any feeling that you could have felt from that moment. You already knew what was happening at the beginning, and it could have just like been cut out, and it wouldn't have had any effect on
it. Hurt the movie immeasurably.
Yeah,
I totally agree with you, and I'll tell you the main reason it hurt for me, and it hurt because it's a bad device. In general.
Yeah.
But Brian Brown's performance is so awesome. And the fact that the entire film, I don't know if you guys have ever been in a situation where you have found yourselves friends or friendly with someone who is very clearly a bully, but they have social power. So you start to convince yourself that this person, if you really get to know this person, they're okay. They're a good guy. They're okay. You know better. But like, they're not being mean to you. Yeah. So you're like, I know you like, I am enamored with Heath Ledger's character constantly saying, oh, you know, Pando's a good guy. He's a good guy. We already know he's not a good guy because he's holding him at gunpoint in the middle of this movie. But we could have not known that until the moment where that's happening and the gun backfires. Again, a brilliant thing you never see in movies. You always see gangsters clean their gun. You never see the consequences of it not cleaning their gun. It's awesome.
I also think that is a huge misstep.
I totally agree.
Part of the Pando thing too is in the Brian Brown performance.
Yes.
Like there is something about him.
The way he's dressed.
The way he's dressed, the way he talks, he doesn't seem like he's intimidating, but he also seems like maybe he could be your friend. Like there is a friendly kind of.
He seems very like approachable at some times.
Totally.
He seems like a nice gangster.
Yeah. It's interesting too, just even the first time we meet him, when Heath and this other guy are basically working outside a strip club trying to get people to come inside, and And Brian Brunn just kind of pulls up and essentially offers Heath the job and says, like, you know, do you want to help me, you know, with, I guess it's essentially some, is it like money movement? Like,
it's
basically,
just a drop
he's just
off.
Yeah, it's just
it's
a
just
drop.
Like someone's got to drop off the money.
Right.
I love how they don't explain why, though. Like, it's we don't really know the motivations towards, like, any of this stuff. But it's
that's also part of the charm of this film, to Kenny's point, which is that, like, the stuff that's important is important. The stuff that isn't important isn't, and just kind of move on.
All the crime movies, all the fun crime movies, the Elmore Leonard stuff that people like, they don't explain this shit. You get Shorty doesn't explain this shit. No. Out of Sight doesn't explain this shit. Like, that's the nuts and bolts of the why, for particularly when it comes to the inciting incidents, don't really matter, you know?
There's something about the tone that I really appreciate. We all love a swing, right? Take a swing, try to do something. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I think the magic realism in this movie kind of works at times. The fractured narrative is unnecessary, but it gets you, I guess, a hard cut to one of the most insane credit sequences we've had of 1999. This credit sequence was just garish and so 90s, with just this hardcore rock song and this this CG kind of overly glistening.
I loved
crazy.
It. I loved so it. The chrome. I thought it was so cool.
I don't know if you guys have seen High Octane, which is like this very short-lived Sofia Coppola TV show that was on Comedy Central.
That sounds interesting.
I watched it at the beginning of the year and it was really good. And the opening, they have a credit sequence and it has to do a lot with cars because the show has they have an obsession with cars, and it kind of reminded me of this just because of the credit sequence for this movie has it's kind of a road show. It has the car titling. Just the music that you'd kind of expect. And so I was watching this, and I was like, this is kind of High Octane. Like, they have similarities.
It's got a Pimp My Ride kind of vibe to it. For good or bad.
Pimp My Ride kind of vibe.
Is kind of great. But I do think that when we meet the brother, who I guess is in some sort of purgatorial space of some sort, I've just been recently rewatching the Evil Dead movies. So I immediately was just like, what are we doing here? Why is there a zombie brother? At first I thought it was Heath.
I had no idea who this person was supposed to be. I think it took me way too long to figure it out because I just didn't know what he was doing.
Right.
He looks so much like him. I was typing my notes. So he's going to die at the end.
Yeah.
And just come back as an older person.
In my notes, I was like, wait, is Heath narrating this from the great beyond? I truly was just I don't
the
understand.
The not so great beyond.
I was what's happening? And then when I realized it was his brother, and I was okay. And truthfully, I don't necessarily have a problem with dead brother, guardian angel, what have you.
Yeah.
But he's not really infused into the story particularly. He just he's there to stop, to fuck with the bullets so that he doesn't die. And then they have this strange interaction.
Shows
on the,
up like every.
Right, what's
30
the train
minutes.
Thing? Did you understand the train moment? Am I crazy?
Cheek.
Yeah.
No, that's what I'm saying. That is at the end of the day when I looked at it, I'm like, I can nitpick. That's the nitpicking part.
Sure.
But I just don't.
I'm not shitting on it. I just want to make sure I didn't understand something.
And what's interesting is all right, how did you guys feel about the moment when Heath is supposed to deliver the money and the woman doesn't answer the door and he goes to the beach and he buries the money?
Oh my God.
And he sees someone he thinks is Rose Byrne going into the pool, into the ocean. He strips down to his skivvies and follows her in. And as he's following her in, the Michael, his dead brother, narrates a part that basically is this is the thesis for this movie. We all make choices in the moment that have reverberations.
Yep.
And how did you guys feel about having some disembodied voice tell you exactly what to feel in the moment.
I didn't care for it because this was like a very simple film. Like the plot wasn't complicated. He's just, the character's kind of stupid to leave the money on in the sand in a crowded beach. But like, I guess maybe that's an Australian thing.
With a big sign
thing.
That says like, there are money. Thieves on this beach.
And like, I love how, I think it's very funny how those kids like ran all the way across to the beach, took the envelope, and he's still like underwater. Like, You can stay under there and hold your breath for like, I don't think they're that fast. And then they just like disappear and go on a shopping spree. And then he gets hit by a car.
They did exactly what kids would do. They go right to the candy store and buy $10,000.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Like handing them like $100 bills.
I do think that I took issue with all the stuff you guys did at the beach. I think that we don't need the VO that spoon feeds us the theme of the movie. It actually weirdly had this, is it Jimmy or is it, it sounds like it's a mixture of VO. Because I could have sworn that Brian Brown was also mixed in there. Am I crazy?
I think you're crazy. Because
I can barely even remember what was like said in the voiceover.
Well, all I know is that the voiceover was very heavy handed, but it weirdly reminded me of Amelie. When like, because the VO in that is also telling you sort of what you're watching in a weird way, like almost like a fairy tale, which it doesn't bother me in Amelie, but in this, it just sort of comes out of nowhere and you just don't need it.
You definitely don't need it.
Yeah.
But who cares?
I didn't bother. And also just for the record, the idea of him walking into the ocean to chase Rose Byrne as clunky as it might be, isn't terrible in terms of the fact that she is obviously going to be his escape from this world of crime. So there is a nice symmetry to that to a certain degree, but all of it's kind of jammed into this weird beach
scene.
That's
not the part. That's the best part of it. The best part of is that he thought she was her.
Yeah. Yeah.
And followed her. Yeah. And I genuinely, I'm never surprised by the like, you know, we're following the guy and oh my God, he's Asian. But I was genuinely surprised that it wasn't her. I really
looked a lot like
her
from behind. Correct.
Yeah. I mean, that hair was like done very well. Whoever they found to get that hair, or whatever.
So this feels like an opportunity. I want to talk about Rose Byrne for a second.
Yeah.
Jared's very excited about
her career. Fascinates me because
it's fascinating.
Because she's someone who I very like, I love and I recognize her, but I have not seen her in so much stuff. She's just kind of that person who you just like her because she's everywhere, but also like her filmography is all over the place.
It is all over the place.
It has gone downwards. I don't know what she has like the same kind of spiral of Naomi Watts. Is this like an Australian curse?
I think Rose Byrne is a little bit
like better at the moment, but Naomi Watts is,
well, I'll say this
don't exist.
About Rose. She does have two great roles in television right now. She was great in Miss America's Gloria Steinem. And I do like Physical for what it's worth.
I think she's really good in it.
She's fantastic. It's a tough show, but she's amazing.
But I'll say this. She's in, as you said, a fuck ton of movies, right? Like she really comes out of this movie and I mean, she's barely in Attack of the Clones, but she's in it, the second Star Wars prequel. And then her first kind of big role, I'd say, is Troy. I think that's when Troy and then Wicker Park in 2004. She's also in Damages around this time as well. Mm-hmm. And Damages was a big show, and she's great in it.
I haven't seen that, but I think she got an Emmy nomination for that.
She did, yeah.
I keep getting ads on Hulu for that, but it's so long.
It's really good.
I haven't bothered.
Damages was, I really think, that moment for her. Because that was right when FX had kind of proven that it's a star-making network. It was across from Glenn Close, and like she just jumps off the screen. You have to find out more about this person. I'd never heard of her before this show. And then following that up with, I guess it wasn't a follow up.
But she's in Mary Antoinette's Sunshine. She's in, it's really Get Him to the Greek.
Get Him to the Greek is what I was going to say.
Is the moment when people are like, she's funny. Yeah.
I have not seen that. As I said, I have not seen her in enough stuff.
When you put up her her performance in Damages, which is deathly serious.
Yes.
And casting her also in Get Into the Greek, which is she's basically playing a female Russell Brand. Like, and she's utterly incredible. Yep.
And then Bridesmaids, obviously.
And then Bridesmaids, which is like transcendent, and she should have been nominated for that. But yeah, she's so funny. The fact that she has that in her quiver is like,
it's crazy.
Who has that?
She has range. That was,
that's the
she has range that people, some people don't know how to take advantage of her acting abilities, which is why she did some like stupid Jon Stewart movie a few years ago with Steve Carell. I did not watch that, but I saw the trailer and I was like, okay, I'm never going to watch this.
Well, she's in Neighbors. Like, here's the thing. She gets into the Apatow world through Get Him to the Greek. Then it's Bridesmaids.
They must have been like, oh my God, look at what
What we found. But then it's also like, sometimes you just get the impression that she just wants to work. And I don't necessarily hold that against her. She does a lot of stuff, right? I mean, the internship, Insidious. But she does Neighbors. She's in both those films, and she's in some X-Men films as sort of a tertiary character that's kind of there. But Instant Family, you saw, right, Kenny? Am I crazy that you saw that?
Instant Family, I think she's great in, because that's something she could do in her sleep. She's just a great actress. Like Neighbors, she basically could do in her sleep.
Yeah,
And there it's like a, it's a similar ask for what she can do. The thing about Rose Byrne that upsets me a little bit is like, okay, I think this is no shade towards Emily Blunt, who I think is like the best, but like Rose Byrne is basically as good as Emily Blunt, and like, and Emily Blunt has like, she does all of it. She does the comedy, she does the drama, she does the action, she does all of it, and I'm confident Rose Byrne can also do all of it, but like maybe because the version of comedy she has done, particularly in Get Into the Greek, and you know, I mean, in fucking Bridesmaids, she had a chocolate fight.
Or Spy as well, which is another version of her doing.
Yes, she's gone maybe a little too far out there to get to pull back and do the super serious stuff that I have seen her do almost as well or as well as Emily Blunt. So I think that's kind of, you know, unfortunate.
That's a fair comparison, but I, you know, I don't know that I would buy Rose Byrne in Edge of Tomorrow, for instance.
I would.
I haven't seen it.
Maybe you're right. Yeah.
I think
if she did it, you'd be surprised.
I'm not like a big Emily Blunt fan. Sorry. But
it's okay.
I have seen her probably in like one thing. So I think that, I mean, I think she's kind of like on the same level as Rose.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting that you bring up Emily Blunt, Kenny, because Emily Blunt doesn't have nearly as many credits as Rose.
She does. She has an incredible amount of credits.
I'm gonna
She does like two films every year for the last like 25 years. Okay. She has a lot of credits.
I'm not saying she doesn't. I'm speaking more to the fact that Rose Byrne has popped more in the stuff she's in than Emily Blunt has. Emily Blunt's career is one of those careers that everyone in Hollywood is like, why didn't... The fulcrum point that everyone hones in on is that she was cast as Black Widow and then she couldn't do it because she was trapped in fucking reshoots on... Gulliver's Travels.
Other people feel differently about this filmography than I do then. Because
I'm just saying that a lot of people feel like had she got the role of Black Widow, that her career trajectory would be very different.
Her career trajectory is incredible.
I don't know. Marvel kind of ruins career. Scarlett Johansson has not done a good movie other than Marriage Story since, or maybe, I don't know. I think she did.
People like Jojo Rabbit. I don't particularly, but
I forgot about that.
Scarlett Johansson.
It was good, but it's not like a memorable movie for me.
Yeah. I agree.
Scarlett Johansson has a great career. But like Emily Blunt, like, look, she won a fucking SAG for A Quiet Place. Like,
I don't do horror, but
acting opposite The Rock, like equal billing with The Rock and Jungle.
You know,
Cruise,
I'm not shitting on Emily
movie.
Blunt.
They had to cast some actress, like 60 years later, they're remaking Mary Poppins. Anybody would have done that role. They went to Emily Blunt. Like, she's doing fine. Like,
listen,
really
I'm not. I'm not saying that she doesn't have a successful career, Kenny. That's not my point here. My point is that role, first of all, I think Scarlett Johansson eventually does a good job as Black Widow. It took her a few movies to find it, but she eventually does.
I blame the people who wrote those movies because they didn't give her, I think they introduced her as someone who's like very attractive, and that's why Scarlett Johansson, I think, was eventually like cast because she was like a kind of like a sex symbol when sex symbols were like big. Yeah. And then they decided like, oh, maybe we should expand her into something not basic.
No, for sure. And again, I'm not even convinced that Emily Blunt would have been totally right as Black Widow either.
She's never been bad. She would have been totally right. Sorry about my dog. She got a fucking SAG nomination for The Girl in the Fucking Train. Like, she's amazing. But, you know, sorry.
She's great in The Devil Wears Prada, which was, I think, amazing. I love that movie.
I love Emily Blunt. I'm not shitting on Emily Blunt.
No, I mean, I'm not like a huge fan of hers. Like, I don't gravitate towards the films that she does. They're kind of like, I wouldn't willingly like watch Jungle Cruise. Like,
she's pretty good in Jungle Cruise.
She is proof to me in Jungle Cruise that she could have chemistry with a tree stump. Because, like,
yes,
she has chemistry, sexual chemistry with The Rock.
We've never heard of that before.
I have seen every single Dwayne Johnson movie. And, like, even the movies were like his, like, saving some damsel thing works. It's not because you believe that they're in love. I mean, even like the one that like I think kind of works is San Andreas, but Carlo Gugino, like the whole thing is that they're like not together anymore. And he's just like kind of saving a person that like he cares about emotionally. But like she has sexual chemistry with
Emily Blunt found sexual chemistry with Tom Cruise as well, which is not an easy thing to do.
Oh, so the other but the other one who like falls into this like category of, you know, British or Australian and fucking kills it and has sexual chemistry with The Rock is now I can't remember her name, but the girl who the woman who is in Jumanji and also
Karen Gillan. Is that her name?
Karen Gillan.
Okay.
She also is like hilarious and can do action and can do
she's
roles.
Another one I'm curious
she's
to
a
see
tremendous actor.
the new Apatow, The Bubble, which comes out on Friday. I'll be curious to see if it's any good, but Karen Gillan is the lead in that, so that's something. I think Rose Byrne is phenomenally talented, shockingly talented at times, like better in the movies than the movies deserve a lot of the time. And it is interesting to see her in this, where I'll be honest, I don't feel like they give her all that much to do, unfortunately. She's kind of just a manic pixie dream girl for him to fall in love with.
I was just about to say that. I don't really like that term because I like some manic pixie dream girl-like
so do
characters.
I. Yeah.
But this one was kind of like, they very much like, she was kind of on the promotional posters, like all of them. So I kind of expected her to be in more than like five or six scenes. And then she was kind of just like sidelined and underutilized.
Yeah, I love her look in this. It's a choice and I'm into it, but it feels like that's 50% of the character for them. and that's dream. You know,
she's a dream girl,
and she's a photographer.
She's a pixie dream girl.
She's artsy, which is like the epitome of that title.
At least she uses an actual camera.
Correct.
Yeah,
that's something.
That's true.
And she also can make a little moment, like seeing the photos get developed and her and seeing the photo of him and the smile on her face, like a totally silent moment that's just unbelievably charming that she sells, that in lesser hands would have felt cloying. I think she does a really good job of making that stuff feel grounded. I think, listen, this is one of the first films she's ever done. So there's definitely scenes where she's just not there yet on some level. I'm speaking specifically of the scene when he's dragged away and she's crying. And I'm just like, I'm not buying these tears, Rose. But
she's just kind of like standing there awkwardly. I would have run away.
I love that scene.
It's a good scene. I'm not
looking at your cab fare. I don't know who made that stupid decision to start the film the way they started it, but like the whole film should have been us understanding why he kind of fell for this guy.
Yep.
And how much it hurt when he realized, oh no, I'm just another guy to him. I'm just another delivery boy to him.
And didn't he like kill his brother too? And he's still like friends with him.
Does he know he killed his brother?
I don't know if he knows he killed his brother.
Well,
until the scene when he says we planted him here, I wonder
if he's really just like, unless he kind of thinks that he killed him, but doesn't want to like come to terms with it.
I think who else is going to kill him? Right? Like, but it was hoping against hope, which I think is a thing that, again, like happens. Like I've seen it happen too many times in social circles where someone who's a bully like picks on someone's best friend and they're just like, yeah, but he's always nice to me. You know, like, but I've never seen it. I know that he kicked you in the stomach and, you know, slapped you in the face, but like, and this happens with Will Smith right now.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Where people, you know,
this happens in Hollywood a lot too, with like abusers and stuff. And you ask like someone who worked with that actor prior. And I can think of like five examples, but
for sure.
You know, just talk about like,
head, right?
Just like Johnny Depp right now is who everyone they ask about, or like Shia LaBeouf, and everyone's kind of like, but he was like nice to me and I didn't see him do anything firsthand. And he's, you know, clean for me, but I can't dictate what he did to other people. And Ansel Elgort as well. The press tour for West Side Story was kind of a mess when they asked all of the women about his.
Well, none of them wanted to talk about it.
And they said, yeah, they kind of were just
position
like,
to put everybody in.
Yeah. I mean, think that's just, to have him ingrained in the press tour without even an acknowledgement was kind of also messy on the part of like the studios for letting him go unscathed a little and like attending all the red carpets. He didn't attend the Oscars, which maybe was a good move for them at the end. But
I gotta say, the Ansel Elgort West Side Story fiasco is a real bummer. I don't think he's great in the movie, but I also don't think that he's horrendous in the movie. I think he's serviceable and that everybody else blows him out of the water. But more than anything, it does feel like on the two hands side of things, that Jimmy is definitely doing his best to try to think the best of Pando, which is very strange. Not completely, you know, unwarranted. It makes me, it's funny, as I was watching this, and I don't know if you guys felt this, but Heath has a bit of an Eddie Adams, Mark Wahlberg, and Boogie Nights vibe in this.
A little bit.
A little bit of just like, a little bit of wide-eyed, a little kind of goofy, not particularly smart, kind of dumb.
He's kind of
but lovable.
He's like leaning towards himbo, but he has a little bit more brains than that.
Yes, for sure.
Not enough brains to you know, not put an envelope in some sand, but
right. But similar to Eddie Adams, who is also sort of trying to see the, first of all, he has no family, so obviously like this world of pornography becomes, these people become his sort of family. But he's also turning a blind eye to what he knows is a don't want to say socially unacceptable, but a questionable universe of characters. And I think it's, I think similarly, Jimmy in this is kind of willing to sort of, he needs this. And because he needs this, he's willing to sort of turn a blind eye to things that he knows are questionable. It's a pretty fascinating role too. Like, he's kind of a doofus. Like the way he is with forgive me, I don't remember Rose's character's name, but the way he is with her is sort of just dumb. Like he's not, it's not that he's not charming. He's just kind of dumb.
I think that's really highlighted by the, like the airport scene where the airplane and like agent or the, you know, the airline agent is like, what do you want to pay with for the tickets with? And he's like, money.
And then the guy's really just sweet.
I know I did, but it was just kind of funny. I thought it was very funny. I think it worked perfect for this for this movie that was also a comedy, and it worked well in that it showed that like their affection for each other.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
It's a weird thing, and I think this is a tribute to Heath and probably the director whose name we should say at some point, Gregor Jordan. I think that it's a little hard to pin down exactly what the traits are that make this character. Mm-hmm. Yet, this is a character I believe in understood every way. Every step of the way.
Yeah,
sure. Like, he is a character who can commit crimes but also be morally upright. He is a character who can do stupid things like burying the money in the sand, but also like be smart enough to be able to handle himself in the middle of a particularly like daunting situation in that bank robbery, which he does mm-hmm. with aplomb.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought the thing with the $10,000 with the radio station was so fucking funny. Like, yeah, I thought so that was funny too. Fucking wonderful. And he knew to run him off the road. Like, that's just silly stuff. And like, just so funny and so good.
Well, it's you know, another movie that this could have been and thankfully was not is Boondock Saints in terms of that type of energy and that type of vibe.
Yeah. If they thought this was all cool, yes.
Right, exactly. And that's part of like, so this, the director Gregor Jordan also did Ned Kelly that Heath was in 2004. He directed that as well. And a movie called Buffalo Soldiers with Joaquin Phoenix, which I have a vague recollection of.
Well, Ned Kelly was, I mean, Ned Kelly's basically like the fucking Davy Crockett of Australia. I mean, like, yeah, he's their Paul Bunyan, but I think he really, really lived. So I think that was probably a big role. That was probably a big get for Greg.
Yeah. But to your point, both of your points, this movie is juggling a tone that is really quite hard to do. And it does it quite well. Dark comedy mixed with elements of magic realism.
I love that about it. Like, yeah. I feel like I'm in good hands. Two good hands during this film.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, sure. I agree with that. This at the same time, I do think this movie is also very 90s. Its production design, its costumes, I mean, its music all feels very much of that period. There was also apparently an alternate ending to this film, which is, so the televised version of the film featured a longer ending immediately after the scene with Jimmy and Alex purchasing their air tickets is a scene where Jimmy's brother, Michael, delivers a brief monologue completing the karmic message of the film. A beam of light shines down from the heavens and Michael attempts to run to the light. However, he is grabbed by a series of hands which erupt from the ground and pull him back down to earth that he escaped from in the opening introduction of the film. Didn't need it. Glad they ended it where they ended it.
Anything with that guy could have been cut out, and it would have would have maybe impacted the film a little bit. It didn't make me hate it or like dislike it more. Yep. I just thought it was something that was there, and it could have been moved all the way to the side.
Yeah,
Phil, he was like a refugee from Little Monsters.
Yes, he was. He was.
I don't know if you've seen that movie, John. It's it's way before your time. By people who look like him.
I want to just talk for a quick second about hitting a child with your car and dumping their body in a gutter and then driving away is some dark shit. And I'm, and to Kenny's point, I'm glad it comes back around at the end and that we get to see that, you know, the retribution for that. But Jesus Christ.
Let's contrast that with how child murder was handled in Gloria. Because like they turned Mike Starr, the child murderer in that film, into like a silly, goofy, you know, naked man. And here, like Akko, who's the Akko, who's the guy who kind of monster, idiot monster, but a guy you like, you desperately wanted to see get his comeuppance, and you got it in a really fucking satisfying, you know, you poetic way. I just like, I think this movie, everything is just handled so fucking well. And the things that are like mistakes aren't the kind of mistakes that fuck with your ability to enjoy the movie. There's just things that you're like, all right, they shouldn't have done that. Or that I didn't need that. But like, they weren't like, they weren't things that mess with you on a cognitive level. Like so many of these films we've done mess with you on a cognitive level where you start to go like, I don't understand what's happening. My sense is they don't understand what's happening, and therefore I don't trust the filmmakers to land this plane. So,
can I ask you guys a question that I wasn't sure what to make of? I have a theory, but this zoom into the eyes with the fire that we get at two or three different occasions in the film
didn't need it.
So after the girl shoots all of them, the camera zooms into her eye and there's like this fire inside her eye. My assumption is that like this is a hell thing. Like this is part of the kind of weird heaven and hell thing. That's I didn't need it, but I also just kind of don't really know what it, I wasn't sure if you guys had any.
Is it maybe to symbolize that like, I don't know, they're evil? People that she killed. Yeah that they're bad people and that she got like her revenge or whatever.
It was a little unnecessary.
I have no idea. I'd like to pretend it didn't happen.
Okay.
No, because the other character who that happened was Michael, who's already dead and in hell. So it's very hard to understand like what through line is. That is a cognitive issue.
Yeah. But whatever.
But again, I don't care.
Yeah.
Because the stuff that doesn't exist on our plane of existence like could be excised for the movie. And in my version of the movie, it has been excised.
So I want to just talk. I want to unpack the robbery a little bit more for a second, because I watched. I don't know if you guys have watched One Perfect Shot, the show that's on HBO Max. It's based on the Twitter feed where Ava DuVernay has brought together filmmakers to talk about scenes and shots from their movies. This is all just a long way of saying that they did one on Heat with Michael Mann, and I watched that, and I spent a half an hour watching. It's fucking dope, and I highly recommend watching it. But what I loved is that I watched that and then watched this bank robbery. Like, to put those two next to each other, obviously Michael Mann's is done with a precision that is that of, you know, unparalleled. And then this, which feels funny and also dangerous and lets you sit in these long moments of awkwardness that I just really loved. Him knocking on the glass to try to get the, like, it's just, it's really good shit.
The POV during this bank robbery, sticking with Heath the entire time was so good.
Yeah. Like, I just love how the guy knocks himself out and like the way that he just like jumps right over it.
And you start to like, think like, yes.
There's just like moment of silence with like everyone in there. Like no one's like crying in the corner. And then he's just like trying to nudge him awake. And I just think that's so... And like a few minutes later, the cops come and they're all like shooting at each other.
Yeah.
It's like, what... All right, so I love that moment too, because they let you sit there long enough to start running through all the scenarios. All right, do you leave them? Well, you can't really leave them because then they'll come back to you. You know, you take the money. Well, like that's like not the nicest thing to do. You know, you can't... So you got to get him out of here, but he tries. He can't pick him up. Oh my God, you got to get this guy out of the car. How do you get out of the car? But you also get out, you knock on the glass. Come here. It's like every little bit of it. Like it's, those are my favorite, you know, those are my favorite, like wrenches in the machine type thing. Weird things like that can happen that nobody possibly will have planned for that you have to deal with like very, like physical things, like things that you actually have to like do the work to figure out. And what we get in so many heist movies and so many movies like that are fucking
digital problems or fucking, things like that. Like, oh, we forgot the code, or, oh no, like the camera that we thought we turned off, we didn't. Like, who gives a shit? Yep. The idea of the guy jumping over the counter, hitting his head and passing out.
It's great. It's also a great stunt, by the way, too. Like, it's all kind of a oneer for a second there, where it's just kind of this manic, omniscient camera for a second. It's great. The dragging is great. Like, all of it's just really good physical comedy, but with attention, obviously.
And here's the other thing. I was afraid that, they tease a bank robbery about half an hour, 45 minutes into this film. And then you kind of lose around the hour mark the need for the bank robbery.
Mm-hmm.
And I was afraid, like when he escapes, like I was afraid that they weren't going to have a bank robbery, like that it was just, teased and then we weren't going to do it.
Yeah.
And to have them have this bank robbery and then have it be such a memorable, original bank robbery without being Heat or The Dark Knight or one of these like epic, like, we are really going to give you something you've never seen before type things. Yep. Have it be three guys in a local fucking branch.
Yep.
And have it be so funny and so cool and so real. Again, like, I think this movie plays on a different fucking level. And it made me want to watch more Australian films. Like, it made me want to watch more films by this director. Like, it made me want to watch more films from countries that don't generally get play over here. Countries outside of there are obviously English films get a lot of play over here. Some European countries, some Asian countries, occasionally you'll get things from other places. But there are these great, interesting films happening all over the world.
Yeah.
That we just never get. And I don't know why we never got this movie. Like, Phil, I believe that you've heard of it. Like, but we never really.
It was a video. I didn't know about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. You talking about that makes me think about, what Bong Joon-ho said when he won the Academy Award about, the plethora of movies that you guys would be open to if you could just see past the 2-inch, subtitles at the bottom. And I really do hand it to Neon, which is doing a pretty superb job of finding really smart, brilliant, audacious foreign films and distributing them really smartly here. I think about obviously Portrait of a Lady, Titan, obviously Parasite, and Worst Person in the World just recently. Like, it's to your point, Kenny, I think that hopefully we're finally starting to see that, like, who gives a shit about subtitles of it
and
all?
And I know that, like,
although I needed them on this movie, by the way, because I didn't understand anything anybody said.
I know this is an Australian film, and obviously it's in English, and we're not blind to that. We get it.
Sure.
But for whatever reason, there has never been a pipeline for these films made in Australia to show up on our shores.
And it's funny because Australia is a really big movie industry. Like, everyone makes movies there, but their movies never get, like, they never reach the popularity that any other English speaking like countries films do, even though, like, their industries are maybe on par with, like, England or even like France is, it's their films are in French, but their films are pretty, like, more mainstream here.
Yeah. Sure. Italian,
and
too.
It's mainly because their actors Spanish are like too. their actors cross over more, but like, we know Nicole Kidman more for her, like, American characters.
Sure.
And like, I did not know Kate Blanchett was, like, Australian until a very long... I thought she was British. Because I felt like she had done more British films.
Yeah,
yeah. Blanchett, Naomi Watts, fucking Hugh Jackman, Russell Crowe, like, Mel Gibson.
Margot Robbie. I think Margot Robbie's, like, the one Australian actor who, like, you can really identify her as, like, an Australian. I don't know. I feel like she keeps her, like... You can hear her accent sometimes come back in some of her
films.
For sure. Eric Bana. I mean, there's so many Australians who, maybe part of it is that it's so easy for an Australian to kind of work their way in through Hollywood. The accents aren't that different. And these Australian actors we've talked about
all do American accents all the time, and no one really gets no one gives them any shit for it. Right. Whereas there are a lot of British actors that I can't listen to their American accents.
I think there's also something. I mean, I know that Taika is Kiwi, but
and there are also a lot of Kiwi people who, particularly directors, Peter Jackson and Campion, and yeah.
It's interesting too how that region, and I don't mean to clump New Zealand with Australia, but I'm going to just for the sake of this argument, is that there is something very audacious about the style of filmmaking that comes out of there too, right? And I think that, you know, we were talking about Baz Luhrmann earlier, Peter Jackson's another example of it, you know, just very sort of in-your-face filmmaking. And sometimes that's off-putting and sometimes that's alienating. But, like, it's theirs. They've planted the flag and this is their shit.
Yeah.
And I think it's fucking dope.
I'm wild about Australia. I paused the movie and started looking at, you know, prices for trips to Australia. It's expensive. I don't know if you guys know that. Yeah, it's not true.
But do you know sort of what I'm getting at, John? Like, there's this... each of these countries we're speaking of all have their own style and their own, you know, culture. And that's what makes them special. And I think, unfortunately, this country wants to homogenize that and wants to try to make it as accessible as is humanly possible. And that is the wrong instinct, obviously.
Yeah. I think that they have like every few years, there's like a good Australian movie that comes out that like is memorable to people. And then like all the other movies are kind of just, they don't exist.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm thinking about like Animal Kingdom, which was remade into an American TV show, which I mean, yes. I love both. And I used to like watch that show a lot.
Sure.
But like Animal Kingdom's like a good Australian that like got the attention. It got like an Oscar nomination and stuff. And that's a good movie.
It is a good movie. It's a really good movie. I love Australian crime. I think, you know, another guy we left off our list of incredible Aussies is George Miller. But
of course,
if you look at, I think George Miller is like in a lot of ways and Baz Luhrmann, like the patron saints of Australian filmmaking, because they are, they're my kind of guys. They're most guys. They're maximalists. And I love that. Even this film had a maximalism quality. Like the things we're complaining about is like they a little too much, but give me too much.
Give me too much.
Please. Yeah. I love too much. Do not give me not enough. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is interesting. You know, I'm curious to see where Taika's career goes. You know, I think that I imagine
he made the most maximalist
coming out this year. So
made the most maximalist MCU movie. He took my least favorite character and made like my favorite MCU movie more or less. And like he's just give. Australians should only be Australians doing MCU movies now.
Yeah, I mean,
James Wan Australian?
I don't think so. But to
Malaysian. On the same part of the country, same part of the world.
On the Taika.
Australian. He is. He's Australian. I'm right. James Wan is Australian. Australians are the best.
I don't have any problems with them. I do think that on the Taika of it all,
Perth when he was seven. Right. Yes.
I think that it's fascinating that Taika has become as big as he has, because I do think it's a very specific brand of comedy. It's a very specific brand of visuals. And I think that I'm just excited about the fact that, you know, I was excited when the trailer for Ragnarok came out. I was like, great. Can't wait to see what this guy has to do with this. And I'm just fascinated by, and I'm thankful by, it does feel like the pool is getting bigger. It feels like we're becoming more and more excited about different visions and different types of people.
Phil, you didn't know James Wan was an Australian?
Are we still doing this? Yeah, I didn't. He is. Obviously,
you should really remember that moving forward.
Okay.
You should be like, we're going to imbue.
Delia. But James Wan is not Justin Lin.
Fuck. It's a great point. I tried to pitch something to James Wan. He didn't do it. It was so upsetting.
Oh,
Justin Lin, I totally forgot.
I could see where you were going, and I wanted to try to put a stop to that before it went any farther. I do want to talk about the radio contest thing for a second. What I love about it is that as it was transpiring, I was like, wait a fucking second. Is this how he's going to get the fucking 10K? And then the fact that it isn't made me
really wonderful.
Because I was like, this is so coincidental. Please don't make this the way that he gets the money. And for him to drive him off the road and kill these radio contestant guys.
We didn't kill him. But well, Larry, seems like we've lost Larry. I love
that little bumper sticker. Like, of course, they went to the car that had the one car. Too hot to handle bumper sticker.
It's great.
I love that guy.
Do you have other thoughts, Kenny? You want to rate this? I want to rate it.
I've wanted to rate it since the moment I saw it.
So, John, on this podcast, we rate our films from 0 to 99, 0 being the lowest, 99 being the highest. Okay. And we rate it before and after the podcast to see whether or not it's changed our opinions. Kenny, do you want to go first?
Do you want me to go first?
I'd love you to go first.
Before the podcast, I gave it a 93. After the podcast, I'm sticking with a 93. I think this movie is going to have some representation, certainly for this batch of 52 in review. That's our end of the year awards for all the films we did. It mm-hmm. might even show up in the actual end of the whole thing. I told my dad to watch it last night. I have not done this. Like, I just I loved it. Like, I've seen so many movies recently that I've hated and have not been able to connect with and engage with. Sure. And I was just bought in with a big fucking smile on my face for most of this film. Really, really loved it. I'm going to watch it again. Like, I think it's just a great film. So, and learned all the right lessons from the American indie cinema boom and the British indie crime boom and put its own spin on it and had fun and took chances and cohesed and, you know, obviously found a star in Heath and found a star in Rose Byrne, pulled an old, you know, trusty guy who does doing a little different something than he's been doing. An old trusty guy. Little nuances that I loved. As I've said, I love the little nuance that Heath, you know, kind of had a little hero worship for Pando and mm-hmm. and had that kind of bring him down, but have that not be like the crux of the movie, which would have been the crux of a lamer, sillier, more boring film. It just was a great film with, and also like we touched upon it, but like a lovely little love story at the middle in the center of it. Like just a lovely little fairy tale about, you know, risking it all.
I liked the film. I didn't like it as much as you. I came into this podcast at a 65.
I was shocked when you said you liked it but didn't love it. I thought this was an obvious movie that we both would love. But okay, go ahead.
But this podcast has certainly bumped that up. I'm now at an 80. I think that this movie is okay. It's got a lot of really good stuff going on in it. I don't know that it all totally comes together tonally for me. I know that some of the things that bumped me, you were able to see past, which is totally fair. So I'm at an 80. Where are you, John?
I think when I first watched, I was maybe at like a 78, 75, that.
Okay.
It was like fun, but I, you know, there were some little things. And then I think now I might be like 10 points higher, maybe like an 88.
Love it.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. So Kenny, okay.
Well, you know what's interesting? Like I've been thinking about this a lot in terms of Licorice Pizza. How there are a couple of things in Licorice Pizza
mm-hmm.
that everyone knows about. That if you love the movie, I think you're able to look past.
100%. Yeah.
And if you're
lukewarm, that's how I feel about it.
You love the movie, so you can kind of like, I'm not super into the people who explain them away. Like I'm not really into people who are explaining away the Asian thing or explaining away the age difference, but like
mm-hmm.
it's part of the movie. And like, that's, you know, I can separate that was not the best thing, but it had nothing to do with, you know, that's how I feel about this movie. Is what I'm getting at, which is like, I know that there's some stuff that like doesn't work, but like, mm-hmm. and I'm not trying to say like, actually it's a representation of his, you know, repressed side. It's a mistake. Like the stuff with his brother is a mistake,
but like it doesn't affect my love for the film because what works for me works on an emotional level
totally.
That triumphs over any other like nitpicks I might have with like mistakes that were made. So,
and that's, I truly hear where you're coming from. There are so many movies for me where that's the case, where I'm just like, yeah, no, that I could see that bumping you. It just doesn't bother me. But you know, and again, I still, this movie is an 80 is not a bad number for this film.
A movie that
like I didn't, you know, really know existed up until, you know, 48 hours ago. And I do think that, you know, it's just great to see these two actors
this joins the tradition of Guinevere, Last Night, Girl on the Bridge, a movie I hardly knew about, which will absolutely have a big place in my end of the year wrap up, end of the podcast wrap up. Like, you have the obvious ones that we're thrilled we did, and then you have these ones that, like, every year there are going to be these movies that no one that just didn't break through for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Like I said with Twin Falls, Idaho, some of these films just need a champion. And if one's championing a movie like this, it just kind of, you know, goes by the wayside. But my sense is people didn't even know this existed.
Well, it's interesting. This movie didn't really get much of a theatrical release here. It was released in Australia in July of 99. It comes out here on DVD shortly thereafter. But again, $4 million budget. It makes almost $6 million. You know, most of that in Australia, but still, you know, it got 71% on Rotten Tomatoes. Like, again, like this wasn't a movie that didn't find a little bit of an audience. But to your point, Kenny, there should have been far more. So it's hopefully people will seek it out. You can rent it solely on Amazon right now for reasons that I don't completely understand, but you should all do so. Neither. It's a really great movie. John, where can people find you if they want to follow you?
My Twitter is my first and last name with an underscore. Mm-hmm. And my Instagram is just my first and last name. It's very basic.
Do you have any pieces that you want to plug or anything that's coming up that you want to talk about or not?
Maybe my Jackass ranking. I like that one.
Oh,
that was a
what's
fun
your
one
Jackass?
For me.
I'm curious. What is your Jackass ranking?
Oh God, I don't even remember. I think my number one was Jackass number two.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
So
what did you have, Kenny? Have you watched all the Jack? Have you watched Forever yet or no?
No, I've only seen the
first
one. Oh,
it's amazing.
And it's on Paramount Plus now, so you can watch
just,
it. It's a lot.
It's amazing. It's glorious. I don't know.
if I have the time, I'll watch them. They're not quite my thing, but
they weren't mine either. Say. I hate shit like that. Like
same, but
physical,
why do they work?
Anything? I have no idea. I bought the DVD set, and like I rewatched it like five times, like every single one, and it's just I don't know. They make me gag, but like it's so fun. Like I feel so sick watching it.
Same.
And maybe if it was out of the context of this, I would just turn it off. But I don't know. There's something so... Maybe it's like just the group of dudes who are just... I don't know. They're very interesting people.
I'd like to keep watching them. I think that the trailer for mm-hmm. Jackass Forever looked mm-hmm. fantastic.
Yep.
And my issue with the first Jackass, which is the only one that I've seen...
Yeah.
Is most of these stunts are not particularly clever. And there's just, it's, some of them are fun. Like some of them, like with the, you know, the crocodiles were fun. And uh-huh. there is some like cleverness to that. But most of them are pretty, you know, basic stuff that anybody, you know, can do by stripping down to their underwear. There's stuff in the Jackass Forever trailer. Like the guy who has the honey and salmon put on him, and then they release the bear into the room. That's good stuff.
It's good shit.
I want to see how that one plays out.
It plays out
that was good.
Pretty fantastically.
I think the stunts in the newer one were obviously like less brutal because they're older.
They're older.
Yeah, they'll die.
But
also, I think it's if these guys can procreate, it is a miracle because the amount of shit they've done to their genitals.
Oh, Johnny has kids.
It's crazy.
I don't remember who. I think it was. I forgot his name. Dave. I don't even know his name.
Yeah, doesn't matter. Sure.
The one who gets hit in the balls a lot with like the baseballs and stuff. Yeah. He said that he had like a kid during the filming.
I mean, they literally they have a UFC fighter who is the has clocked the strongest punch in the world. Punch him in the balls.
I do want to watch this now. You have convinced me. It was interesting. I mean, it's not interesting. We used to be on Johnny Knoxville's Christmas card list because Laura, really? My wife, was really close with his wife.
Okay.
Her name is Naomi. And she used to talk about her boyfriend, PJ. I don't know if you know his real name is PJ Clapp.
Oh, yeah. I saw that on Wikipedia.
She was talking about her boyfriend, PJ, and not mention that he was Johnny Knoxville, not mention that he was famous. And like, she finally saw his picture. She's like, he looks a lot like John. And you know, Johnny Knoxville is just aside from being a total lunatic, like one of the handsomest guys. And it's a weird thing that he is so handsome. But she's just like, he's a handsome guy who looks like Johnny Knoxville. Lo and behold, it's actually Johnny Knoxville. I think they've been married for like 20 years. They have kids.
That's incredible.
And Laura loves the wife. Yeah.
There's something very charismatic about him. Now, admittedly, that career never happened, despite the fact that there was an attempt. I mean, the Dukes of Hazzard movie and there were, you know, The Ringer, and like people tried. But in this,
tried to branch out with Bad Grandpa, which was like their last one before they came back. And it didn't really work. I mean, I think that one's funny. And some people don't think the grandpa bits aren't funny. I like them because maybe I find that.
The grandpa bits are good.
It's some of them are good. Some of them are bad. Like with Gloria, I like those.
I'm going to keep going with these.
I think it's to me, I almost saw it in the theater. I'm glad that I did.
You saw, there are five, right, John?
Yes, there
are. Yeah. Well, Grandpa. There's four plus Bad Grandpa. Yeah. And then there's the 3.5. So there's like eight or nine. And then there's another one coming out.
How many have you seen, Phil?
I've only seen one, two, and forever.
Forever.
So like I've only seen
three is the like second best one.
Wait, is that there's a third one?
The 3D one,
right? Yeah. Oh, I did see 3D. I'm sorry, I've seen those.
That one has some of the best stunts.
Great 3D stuff in that. Truthfully, Kenny, I put it on because I was like, I wanted to see it in the theater. I'm glad I didn't because I don't know that I wanted to be trapped in a room with that movie. Like, I think that it's the type of thing that, you know, pause, watch it in installments or whatever the case might be, because obviously there's no story. I don't know. I'll say this as well as a disclaimer. My roommate, Melissa, had never seen Jackass, never seen a lick of it, didn't even really know what it was. I made her watch like the last 15 minutes of Jackass Forever. And truly, she was like, I can't watch this. I'm going to vomit. Why would anybody want to subject themselves to this? So there is something very upsetting about them as well.
Yeah. So, I don't know what brought me to watching these, especially as someone who can't even like stomach horror movies. But then like I just like put on Jackass the movie and I was like, okay, this is like pretty good. And then I watched like every single one of them in like a whole day. And then I went to the theater and saw it forever. And I was like, okay, these are like really amazing. This is like true cinema.
They should check out your rankings of the Jackass films. They should follow you on social media. This was a blast, and we thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. I had and we so hope much that fun.
We hope you'll come back in the future for something on our Patreon, possibly, whatever the case might be. But thank you so, so much. This was a blast.
Thank you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.